pouring tea into delicate, thin-rimmed cups, sets the teapot on a trivet in the middle of the polished coffee table. She hands Mr. Sorensen a cup and offers him the sugar bowl.
"Marvelous, Mrs. Murphy,"
he says, and dumps 4 spoons of sugar into his cup. He adds milk, stirs it noisily, rests the small silver spoon on the rim of his saucer, and takes a long slurp.
"Mr. Sorensen,"
Mrs. Murphy says when his cup is back in its resting place,
"a thought occurs. May I speak with you in the foyer?"
"Why, certainly."
He wipes his mouth with a pink napkin and gets up to follow her into the hall. When the door closes behind them, Miss Larson takes a sip of tea and places her cup back on its saucer with a little rattle. The brass lamp on the round table between us emits an amber glow. "I'm sorry you have to go through this, but I'm sure you understand that Mrs. Murphy, generous-hearted as she is, can't take you in indefinitely. You do understand, don't you?" "Yes." There's a lump in my throat. I don't trust myself to say more. When Mrs. Murphy and Mr. Sorensen come back into the room, she fixes her steady gaze on him and smiles.
"You are quite a fortunate girl,"
he tells me.
"This extraordinary woman."
He beams at Mrs. Murphy and she lowers her eyes.
"Mrs. Murphy has brought to my attention that a couple named the Nielsens, friends of hers, own the general store on Center Street. 5 years ago, they lost their only child."
"Diphtheria, I believe it was, poor thing," Mrs. Murphy adds.
"Yes, yes, tragedy,"
Mr. Sorensen says.
"Well, apparently, they've been looking for help with the shop. Mrs. Nielsen contacted Mrs. Murphy several weeks ago, asking whether any young woman in residence was seeking employment. And then, when you washed up on her doorstep..."
Perhaps sensing that this characterization of how I got here might be perceived as insensitive, he chuckles.
"Forgive me, Mrs. Murphy, a figure of speech."
"Quite all right, Mr. Sorensen. We understand you meant no harm by it."
Mrs. Murphy pours more tea into his cup and hands it to him, then turns to me.
"After speaking with Miss Larson about your situation, I told Mrs. Nielsen about you. I said that you are a sober-minded and mature, almost 11-year-old girl, that you have impressed me with your ability to sew and clean, and that I have no doubt you could be of use to her. I explained that while adoption may be the most desirous eventual result, it is not expected." She clasps her hands together. "And so Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen have agreed to meet with you."
I know I am expected to respond, to express gratitude, but it takes a conscious effort to smile, and several moments to form the words. I am not grateful. I am bitterly disappointed. I don't understand why I need to leave, why Mrs. Murphy can't keep me if she thinks I am so well-mannered. I don't want to go into another home where I'm treated like a servant, tolerated only for the labor I can provide.
"How kind of you, Mrs. Murphy," Miss Larson exclaims, plunging into the silence. "That's wonderful news, isn't it, Dorothy?"
"Yes. Thank you, Mrs. Murphy," I say, choking out the words.
"You're quite welcome, child. Quite welcome."
She beams proudly. "Now, Mr. Sorensen, perhaps you and I should attend this meeting as well." Mr. Sorensen drains his teacup and sets it in his saucer.
"Indeed, Mrs. Murphy. I am also thinking that the two of us should meet separately to discuss the finer points of this transaction. What would you say to that?"
Mrs. Murphy blushes and blinks. She shifts in her chair, picks up her teacup, and then puts it down without taking a sip.
"Yes, that's probably wise," she says.
And Miss Larson looks over and gives me a smile. Hemingford, Minnesota, 1930. Over the next few days, every time I see her, Mrs. Murphy has another suggestion for how I should comport myself on meeting the Nielsens.
"A firm handshake, but not a squeeze," she says, passing me on the stairs. "You must be ladylike. They need to know that you can be trusted behind the counter," she lectures at dinner.
The other women chime in. "Don't ask questions," one advises.
"But answer them without hesitation," another adds. Make sure your fingernails are clipped and groomed. Clean your teeth just before with baking soda. Your hair must be... Miss Grund grimaces and reaches up to her own head, as if patting down soap bubbles. Tamed. You never know how they might feel about a redhead, especially that tinny shade. Now, now, Miss Larson says. We're going to scare the poor girl so much she won't know how to act. On the morning of the meeting, a Saturday in mid-December, there is a light knock on my bedroom door. It's Mrs. Murphy, holding a navy blue velvet dress on a hanger. Let's see if this fits, she says, handing it to me. I'm not sure whether to invite her in or to close the door while I change, but she solves this dilemma by bustling in and sitting on the bed. Mrs. Murphy is so matter-of-fact that I am not ashamed to take my clothes off and stand there in my knickers. She removes the dress from the hanger, unzips a seam at the side that I hadn't realized was a zipper, and lifts it over my head, helping me with the long sleeves, pulling down the gathered skirt, zipping it up again. She steps back in the small space to inspect me, yanks at one side and then the other, tugs at a sleeve. Let's see about that hair, she says, instructing me to turn around so she can take a look. Fishing in her apron pocket, she pulls out bobby pins and a hair clip. For the next few minutes, she pokes and prods, pulling the hair back from my face and smoothing it into submission. When she's finished, to her satisfaction, she turns me around to look at my reflection in the glass. Despite my trepidation about meeting the Nielsens, I can't help smiling. For the first time since Mr. Grote butchered my hair months ago, I look almost pretty. I've never worn a velvet dress before. It is heavy and a little stiff, with a full skirt that falls in a lush drape to my mid-calf. It gives off a faint scent of mothballs whenever I move. I think it's beautiful, but Mrs. Murphy isn't satisfied. Narrowing her eyes at me and clicking her tongue, she pinches the material. "Wait a minute, I'll be right back," she says, hurrying out and returning a few moments later with a wide black ribbon. "Turn around," she instructs, and when I do, she loops the sash around my waist and ties it in the back with a wide bow. We both inspect her handiwork in the mirror. "There we are. You look like a princess, my dear," Mrs. Murphy declares. "Are your black stockings clean?" I nod. "Put them on, then, and your black shoes will be fine." She laughs, her hands on my waist. "A red-headed Irish princess you are, right here in Minnesota." At 3 o'clock that afternoon, in the early hours of the first heavy snowstorm of the season, I greet Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen in Mrs. Murphy's parlor, with Mr. Sorensen and Miss Larson standing by. Mr. Nielsen resembles a large gray mouse, complete with twitching whiskers, pink-tinged ears, and a tiny mouth. He is wearing a gray three-piece suit and a silk-striped bow tie, and he walks with a black cane. Mrs. Nielsen is thin, almost frail. Her dark head of hair, streaked with silver, is pulled back in a bun. She has dark eyebrows and eyelashes and deep-set brown eyes, and her lips are stained a dark red. She wears no powder or rouge on her olive skin. Mrs. Murphy puts the Nielsens at ease, plying them with tea and biscuits and inquiring about their short trip across town in the snow, and then remarking generally on the weather, how the temperature dipped in the past few days and snow clouds gathered slowly to the west, how the storm finally began today, as everyone knew it would. They speculate about how much snow we are bound to get tonight, how long it will stay on the ground, when we might expect more snow, and what kind of winter it will be. Surely it won't rival the winter of 1922, when ice storms were followed by blizzards and nobody could get any relief. Or the Black Dust Blizzard of 1923, remember that, when dirty snow blew down from North Dakota, 7-foot snowdrifts covered entire sections of the city, and people didn't leave their houses for weeks? On the other hand, there's little chance that it will be as mild as 1921, the warmest December on record. The Nielsens are politely curious about me, and I do my best to answer their questions without sounding either desperate or apathetic. The other three adults watch us with a quivering intensity. I sense them urging me to do well, to sit up straight and answer incomplete sentences. Finally, as one conversational theme after another runs its course, Mr. Sorensen says, "All right, then. I believe we all know why we are here.
to determine whether the Nielsens might be willing to provide Dorothy with a home, and whether Dorothy is suitable to their needs. To that end, Dorothy, can you tell the Nielsens why you wish to become part of their household, and what you might bring to it yourself?
If I am honest, which is not, of course, what Mr. Sorensen is asking of me, I will say that I simply need a warm, dry place to live. I want enough food to eat, clothes and shoes that will protect me from the cold. I want calmness and order. More than anything, I want to feel safe in my bed. I can sew. I am quite neat. I am good with numbers, I say. Mr. Nielsen, turning to Mrs. Murphy, asks,
And can the young lady cook and clean? Is she hard-working?
Is she a Protestant? Mrs. Nielsen adds. She is a hard-working girl, I can attest to that, Mrs. Murphy says. I can cook some things, I tell them, though at my previous residence I was expected to make stew out of squirrels and raccoons, and I'd rather not do that again.
Mercy, no, Mrs. Nielsen says.
And the other question? The other question? I'm barely keeping up. Do you go to church, dear? Mrs. Murphy prompts. Oh, right. The family I lived with were not church-going people, I answer honestly, though in truth I have not been to church since the chapel at the Children's Aid Society, and before that only with Graham. I remember clasping her hand as we walked to St. Joseph's, right in the center of Kinvara, a small church made of stone with jewel-toned stained-glass windows and dark oak pews. The smell of incense and lilies, the candles lit for loved ones passed away, the throaty intonations of the priest, and the majestic trumpeting of the organ. My da said he was allergic to religion. It never did anybody any good. And when Mam got grief from the neighbors on Elizabeth Street about not going to services, she'd say, You try packing up a swarm of kids on a Sunday morning when one has a fever, one has the colic, and your husband's passed out in the bed. I remember watching other Catholics, girls in their communion dresses and boys in their spit-shined shoes, walking down the street below our apartment, their mothers pushing prams and fathers strolling along beside.
She's an Irish girl, Viola, so I suspect she's a Catholic,
Mr. Nielsen says to his wife. I nod.
You may be a Catholic, child,
Mr. Nielsen says, the first thing he has said to me directly.
But we are Protestant, and we will expect you to go to Lutheran services with us on Sundays.
It's been years since I've attended services of any kind, so what does it matter? Yes, of course.
And you should know that we will send you to school in town here, a short walk from our home, so you won't attend Miss Larson's classes any longer.
Miss Larson says, I believe Dorothy was about to outgrow the schoolhouse anyway. She's such a smart girl.
And after school, Mr. Nielsen says, you will be expected to help in the store. We'll pay you an hourly wage, of course. You know about the store, Dorothy, do you not?
It's sort of a general interest, all-purpose place, Mrs. Nielsen says. I nod and nod and nod. So far they've said nothing that raises an alarm. But I don't feel the spark of connection with them either. They don't seem eager to learn about me, but then again, few people are. I get the sense that my abandonment and the circumstances that brought me to them matter little to them compared to the need I might fill in their lives. The following morning, at 9 a.m., Mr. Nielsen pulls up in a blue and white Studebaker with silver trim and wraps on the front door. Mrs. Murphy has been so generous that I now have two suitcases and a satchel filled with clothes and books and shoes. As I'm closing my bags, Miss Larson comes to my room and presses Anne of Green Gables into my hands. It's my own book, not the school's. And I want you to have it, she says, hugging me goodbye. And then, for the fourth time since I first set foot in Minnesota over a year ago, everything I possess is loaded into a vehicle and I am on my way to somewhere new. Hemingford, Minnesota, 1930-1931. The Nielsen's home is a two-story colonial painted yellow with black shutters and a long slate walkway leading to the front door. It sits on a quiet street several blocks from the center of town. Inside, the floor plan is a circle,
A sunny living room on the right leads into the kitchen in the back, which connects to a dining room and back to the foyer. Upstairs, I have my own large room, painted pink, with a window overlooking the street, and even my own bathroom, with a large porcelain sink and pink tiles and a cheerful white curtain with pink piping. Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen take things for granted that I've never dared to dream of. All the rooms have steel air vents with black-painted scroll work. Even when no one is home, the water heater is on, so that when they come home after work, they don't have to wait for the water to heat up. A woman named Bess cleans the house and does the washing once a week. The refrigerator is stocked with milk and eggs and cheese and juice, and Mrs. Nielsen notices what I like to eat and buys more of it. Oats for breakfast, for instance, and fruits, even exotic ones like oranges and bananas. I find aspirin and store-bought toothpaste in the medicine cabinet and clean towels in the hall closet. Every 2 years, Mr. Nielsen tells me, he trades in his car for a new model. On Sunday morning, we go to church. Grace Lutheran is different from any place of worship I've ever seen. A simple white building with a steeple, Gothic arched windows, oak pews, and a spare altar. I find the rituals comforting. The tried-and-true hymns, sermons by the mild-mannered, slope-shouldered reverend that emphasize decency and good manners. Mr. Nielsen and other parishioners grumble about the organist, who either plays so fast that we jumble the words, or so slow that the songs become dirges, and he can't seem to take his foot off the pedal. But nobody actually protests. They just raise their eyebrows at each other mid-song and shrug. I like the assumption that everyone is trying his best, and we should all just be kind to each other. I like the coffee hour with almond cake and snickerdoodles in the vestry. And I like being associated with the Nielsens, who seem to be generally regarded as fine, upstanding citizens. For the first time in my life, the glow of other people's approval extends to and envelops me. Life with the Nielsens is calm and orderly. Each morning at 5:30, 6 days a week, Mrs. Nielsen makes breakfast for her husband, usually fried eggs and toast, and he leaves for the store to open for the farmers at 6. I get ready for school and leave the house at 7:45 for the 10-minute walk to the schoolhouse, a brick building that holds 60 children separated into grades. On my first day in this new school, the fifth-grade teacher, Miss Bushkowski, asks the 12 of us in her class to introduce ourselves and list one or two of our hobbies. I've never heard of a hobby, but the boy before me says playing stickball and the girl before him says stamp collecting, so when the question comes to me, I say sewing. "Lovely, Dorothy," Miss Bushkowski says. "What do you like to sew?" "Clothes, mostly," I tell the class. Miss Bushkowski smiles encouragingly. "For your dolls?" "No, for ladies." "Well, isn't that nice?" she says in a too bright voice. And in that way, it becomes clear to me that most 10-year-olds probably don't sew clothes for ladies. And so I begin to adjust. The kids know I've come from somewhere else, but as time passes and with careful effort, I lose any trace of an accent. I note what the girls my age are wearing, and the style of their hair, and the subject of their conversations, and I work hard to banish my foreignness, to make friends, to fit in. After school, at 3 o'clock, I walk directly to the store. Nielsen's is a large open space, divided into aisles, with a pharmacy in the back, a candy section up front, clothes, books, and magazines, shampoo, milk, and produce. My job is to stack shelves and help with inventory. When it's busy, I help out at the cash register. From my place at the counter, I see longing in the faces of certain children, the ones who sidle into the store and linger in the candy aisle, eyeing the hard striped sticks with a fierce hunger I remember only too well. I ask Mr. Nielsen if I can use my own earnings to give a child a stick of penny candy now and then, and he laughs. "Use your discretion, Dorothy. I won't take it out of your wages." Mrs. Nielsen leaves the store at 5 to start dinner. Sometimes I go home with her, and sometimes I stay and help Mr. Nielsen close up. He always leaves at 6. At dinner, we talk about the weather and my homework and the store. Mr. Nielsen is a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and conversations often include discussion of initiatives and plans for stimulating business in this unruly economy, as he calls it. Late at night, Mr. Nielsen sits in the parlor at his roll-top desk, going over the store ledgers, while Mrs. Nielsen prepares our lunches for the next day, tidies the kitchen, takes care of household tasks. I help wash the dishes, sweep the floor. When chores are done, we play checkers or hearts and listen to the radio. Mrs. Nielsen teaches me to needlepoint. While she's making intricately detailed pillows for the sofa, I work on the floral cover for a stool. One of my first tasks at the store is to help decorate for Christmas. Mrs. Nielsen and I bring boxes filled with glass balls and china ornaments and ribbon and strings of sparkling beads up from the storage room in the cellar. Mr. Nielsen has his two delivery boys, Adam and Thomas, drive to the outskirts of town to cut a tree for the window, and we spend an afternoon putting swags of greenery with red velveteen bows over the store entrance and decorating the tree, wrapping empty boxes in foil paper and tying them with flocked ribbon and silk cording. As we work together, Mrs. Nielsen tells me bits and pieces about her life. She is Swedish, though you wouldn't know it. Her people were dark-eyed gypsies who came to Gothenburg from Central Europe. Her parents are dead, her siblings scattered. She and Mr. Nielsen have been married for 18 years, since she was 25 and he was in his early 30s. They thought they couldn't have children. But about 11 years ago, she got pregnant. On July 7th, 1920, their daughter, Vivian, was born. "What is your birth date again, Dorothy?" Mrs. Nielsen asks. "April 21st. Carefully, she threads silver ribbon through the tree branches in the back, ducking her head so I can't see her face. Then she says, "You girls are almost the same age." "What happened to her?" I venture. Mrs. Nielsen has never mentioned her daughter before, and I sense that if I don't ask now, I may not get the chance. Mrs. Nielsen ties the ribbon to a branch and bends down to find another. She attaches the end of the new ribbon to the same branch to make it look continuous and begins the process of weaving it through. "When she was 6, she developed a fever. We thought it was a cold. Put her to bed," called the doctor. "He said we should let her rest. Give her plenty of fluids, the usual advice. But she didn't get better. And next thing we knew, it was the middle of the night, and she was delirious. Out of her mind, really. And we called the doctor again, and he looked down her throat and saw the telltale spots. We didn't know what it was, but he did. We took her to St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, and they quarantined her. When they told us there was nothing they could do, we didn't believe them. But it was just a matter of time." She shakes her head, as if to clear the thought. I think about how hard it must have been for her, losing a daughter. And I think of my brothers and Maisie. We have a lot of sadness inside us, Mrs. Nielsen and I. I feel sorry for the both of us. On Christmas Eve, in a soft snowfall, the three of us walk to church. We light candles on the 20-foot tree to the right of the altar, all the fair-haired Lutheran children and parents and grandparents singing with songbooks open, the Reverend preaching a sermon as elemental as a story in a child's picture book, a lesson about charity and empathy. "People are in dire need," he tells the congregation. "If you have something to give, give. Rise to your best selves." He talks about some families in crisis. Hog farmer John Slattery lost his right arm in a threshing accident. They need canned goods and any manpower you can spare while they try to salvage the farm. Mrs. Abel, 87 years old, blind now in both eyes and all alone. "If you can see it in your heart to spare a few hours a week, it would be greatly appreciated." A family of 7. The Groats, in dire straits, the father out of work, 4 young children and another born prematurely a month ago, now sickly, the mother unable to get out of bed. "How sad," Mrs. Nielsen murmurs. "Let's put together a package for that poor family." She doesn't know my history with them. They're just another distant calamity. After the service, we walk back through quiet streets. The snow has stopped and it's a clear, cold night. The gas lamps cast circles of light. As the three of us approach the house, I see it as if for the first time. The porch light shining, an evergreen wreath on the door, the black iron railing and neatly shoveled walkway. Inside, behind a curtain, a lamp in the living room glows. It's a pleasant place to return to. A home. Every other Thursday after supper, Mrs. Nielsen and I join Mrs. Murphy and six other ladies at a quilting group. We meet in the spacious parlor room of the wealthiest lady in the group, who lives in a grand Victorian on the outskirts of town. I am the only child in a room full of women and am immediately at ease. We work together on one quilt, a pattern and fabric that a member of the group has brought in. As soon as that one is finished, we'll move to the next. Each quilt takes about 4 months to finish. This group, I learn, made the quilt on my bed in the pink bedroom. It's called Irish Wreath. Four purple irises with green stems meeting in the middle on a black background. "We'll make a quilt for you someday too, Dorothy," Mrs. Nielsen tells me. She begins to save cuttings from the fabric station in the store. Every scrap goes into a steamer trunk with my name on it. We talk about it at dinner. A lady bought 10.5 yards of a beautiful blue calico, and I saved the extra half yard for you, she'll say. I've already decided on the pattern. A double wedding ring, a series of interlocking circles made up of small rectangles of fabric. Once a month, on a Sunday afternoon, Mrs. Nielsen and I polish the silver. From a deep drawer in the cabinet in the dining room, she takes out a heavy mahogany box that contains the cutlery she was given by her mother as a wedding present. Her only inheritance, she tells me. Removing the pieces one by one, she lines them up on tea towels on the table, while I gather two small silver bowls from the living room mantel, four candlesticks, and a serving platter from the sideboard, and a hinged box with her name, Viola, in spidery script across the top from her bedroom. We use a heavy, mud-colored paste in a jar, a few small stiff brushes, water, and lots of rags. One day, as I am polishing an ornately decorated serving spoon, Mrs. Nielsen points at her clavicle and says, without looking at me, "We could clean that up for you if you like." I touch the chain around my neck, following it with my finger down to the clatter. Reaching back with both hands, I unfasten the clasp. "Use the brush. Be gentle," she says. "My gram gave this to me," I tell her. She looks at me and smiles. Warm water, too. As I work the brush along the chain, it is transformed from a dull gray to the color of tinsel. The cladda charm, its details obscured by tarnish, becomes three-dimensional again. "There," Mrs. Nielsen says when I've rinsed and dried the necklace and put it on again. "Much better." And though she doesn't ask anything about it, I know this is her way of acknowledging that she knows it holds meaning for me. One night at dinner, after I have been living in their house for several months, Mr. Nielsen says, "Dorothy, Mrs. Nielsen and I have something to discuss with you." I think Mr. Nielsen is going to talk about the trip they've been planning to Mount Rushmore, but he looks at his wife, and she smiles at me, and I realize it's something else. Something bigger. "When you first came to Minnesota, you were given the name Dorothy," she says. "Are you particularly fond of that name?" "Not particularly," I say, unsure where this is going.
"You know how much our Vivian meant to us, don't you?"
Mr. Nielsen says. I nod.
"Well,"
Mr. Nielsen's hands are flat on the table,
"it would mean a lot to us if you would take Vivian's name. We consider you our daughter. Not legally yet, but we are beginning to think of you that way. And we hope that you are beginning to think of us as your parents."
They look at me expectantly. I don't know what to think. What I feel for the Nielsens, gratitude, respect, appreciation, isn't the same as a child's love for her parents. Not quite. Though what that love is, I'm not sure I can say. I am glad to be living with this kind couple, whose quiet, self-effacing manner I am coming to understand. I am grateful that they took me in. But I am also aware every day of how different I am from them. They are not my people, and never will be. I don't know how I feel, either, about taking their daughter's name. I don't know if I can bear the weight of that burden. Let's not pressure her, Hank. Turning to me, Mrs. Nielsen says, take the time you need, and let us know. You have a place in our home, whatever you decide. Several days later, in the store stocking shelves in the canned food aisle, I hear a man's voice I recognize but can't place. I stack the remaining cans of corn and peas on the shelf in front of me, pick up the empty cardboard box, and stand up slowly, hoping to determine who it is without being seen.
I got some fine piecework to barter, if you're amenable.
I hear a man say to Mr. Nielsen, standing behind the counter. Every day people come into the store with reasons why they can't pay, asking for credit or offering goods for trade. Every evening, it seems, Mr. Nielsen brings something home from a customer. A dozen eggs, soft Norwegian flatbread called lefse, a long knitted scarf. Mrs. Nielsen rolls her eyes and says, mercy. But she doesn't complain. I think she's proud of him, for being kind-hearted, and for having the means to be.
Dorothy?
I turn around, and with a little shock I realize it's Mr. Byrne. His auburn hair is lank and unkempt, and his eyes are bloodshot. I wonder if he's been drinking. What is he doing here, in the general store of a town 30 miles from his own?
Well, this is a surprise, he says. You work here?
I nod. The owners, the Nielsens, took me in. Despite the February cold, sweat is trickling down Mr. Byrne's temple. He wipes it away with the back of his hand.
So, you happy with them?
Yes, sir. I wonder why he's acting so odd. How's Mrs. Byrne? I ask, trying to steer the conversation to pleasantries. He blinks several times.
You haven't heard.
Pardon? Shaking his head, he says,
she was not a strong woman, Dorothy. Couldn't take the humiliation. Couldn't bear to beg for favors. But what should I have done different? I think about it every day.
His face contorts.
When Fanny left, it was the...
Fanny left? I don't know why I'm surprised, but I am.
A few weeks after you did. Came in one morning and said her daughter up in Park Rapids wanted her to live with them, and she'd decided to go. We'd lost everyone else, you know, and I think Lois just couldn't bear the thought.
He wipes his hand across his whole face, as if trying to erase his features.
Remember the freak storm that blew through last spring? Late April, it was. Well, Lois walked out into it. And kept walking. They found her froze to death about 4 miles from the house.
I want to feel sympathy for Mr. Byrne. I want to feel something, but I cannot. I'm sorry, I tell him. And I suppose I am sorry for him, for his tattered life. But I cannot muster any sorrow for Mrs. Byrne. I think of her cold eyes and perpetual scowl. Her unwillingness to see me as anything more than a pair of hands, fingers holding a needle and thread. I am not glad she is dead, but I am not sorry she is gone. At dinner that evening, I tell the Nielsens I will take their daughter's name. And in that moment, my old life ends and a new one begins. Though I find it hard to trust that my good fortune will continue, I am under no illusions about what I've left behind. So when, after several years, the Nielsens tell me that they want to adopt me, I readily agree. I will become their daughter, though I never can bring myself to call them mother and father. Our affiliation feels too formal for that. Even so, from now on, it is clear that I belong to them. They are responsible for me, and will take care of me. As time passes, my real family becomes harder and harder to remember. I have no photographs, or letters, or even books from that former life. Only the Irish cross from my gram. And though I rarely take the clatter off, as I get older, I can't escape the realization that the only remaining piece of my blood family comes from a woman who pushed her only son and his family out to sea in a boat, knowing full well she'd probably never see them again. Hemingford, Minnesota, 1935 to 1939. I am 15 when Mrs. Nielsen finds a pack of cigarettes in my purse. It's clear when I walk into the kitchen that I've done something to displease her. She is quieter than usual, with an air of injured aggravation. I wonder if I'm imagining it. I try to remember if I said or did anything to upset her before I left for school. The pack of cigarettes, which my friend Judy Smith's boyfriend bought for her at the Esso station outside of town, and which she passed along to me, doesn't even register in my mind. After Mr. Nielsen comes in and we sit down to supper, Mrs. Nielsen slides the pack of Lucky Strikes toward me across the table. "I was looking for my green gloves and thought you might have borrowed them," she says. "I found this instead." I look at her, then at Mr. Nielsen, who lifts his fork and knife and begins cutting his pork chop into small pieces. "I only smoked one to try it," I say, though they can clearly see that the pack is half empty. "Where'd you get it?" Mrs. Nielsen asks. I am tempted to tell them it was Judy's boyfriend, Douglas, but realize it will only be worse to drag other people in. "It was an experiment. I didn't like it. They made me cough." She raises her eyebrows at Mr. Nielsen, and I can tell they've already decided on a punishment. The only thing they can really take away is my weekly Sunday afternoon trip to the picture show with Judy, so for the next 2 weeks, I stay home instead, and endure their silent reprobation. After this, I decide that the cost of upsetting them is too much. I don't climb out my bedroom window and down the drainpipe like Judy. I go to school and work in the store and help with dinner and do my homework and go to bed. I go out with boys now and then, always on a double date or in groups. One boy in particular, Ronnie King, is sweet on me and gives me a promise ring. But I am so worried I might do something to disappoint the Nielsens that I avoid any situation that might lead to impropriety. Once, after a date, Ronnie tries to kiss me goodnight. His lips brush mine, and I pull back quickly. Soon after that, I give back his ring. I never lose the fear that any day Mr. Sorensen could be on the doorstep, telling me that the Nielsens have decided I'm too expensive, too much trouble, or merely a disappointment, and they've decided to let me go. In my nightmares, I am alone on a train, heading into the wilderness, or in a maze of hay bales, or walking the streets of a big city, gazing at lights in every window, seeing the families inside, none of them mine. One day I overhear a man at the counter talking to Mrs. Nielsen.
"My wife sent me in here to get some things for a basket our church is putting together for a boy who came on that orphan train," he says. "Remember those? Used to come through a while ago with all those homeless waifs. I went to the Grange Hall in Albans once to see him. Pitiful lot. Anyhow, this kid had one misfortune after another, got beat up pretty bad by the farmer who took him in, and now the elderly lady he went to after that has died, and he's on his own again. It's a scandal, sending those poor kids out here on their own, expecting folks to take care of them, as if we don't have our own burdens."
"Mm-hmm," Mrs. Nielsen says noncommittally. I move closer, wondering if he might be talking about Dutchie. But then I realize Dutchie is 18 now, old enough to be on his own. I am nearly 16 when I look around the store and realize that it has barely changed in all the time I've been here. And there are things we can do to make it nicer. A lot of things. First, after consulting Mr. Nielsen, I move the magazines to the front, near the cash register. The shampoos and lotions and balms that used to be at the back of the store, I shift to shelves near the pharmacy, so that people filling prescriptions can also buy plasters and ointments. The women's section is woefully understocked, understandable, given Mr. Nielsen's general ignorance and Mrs. Nielsen's lack of interest. She does wear an occasional coat of lipstick, though it always seems to have been randomly chosen and hurriedly applied. Remembering the long discussions about stockings and garters and makeup rituals at Mrs. Murphy's, I suggest that we increase and expand this section, purchasing, for example, a hosiery carousel with seamed and unseamed stockings from one of the vendors, and advertise it in the paper. The Nielsens are skeptical, but in the first week we go through our entire stock. The following week, Mr. Nielsen doubles the order. Recalling what Fanny said about ladies wanting to feel pretty even when they don't have much money, I convince Mr. Nielsen to order small, inexpensive items, sparkling costume jewelry and gloves made of cotton velvet, Bakelite wrist bangles and colorful printed scarves. There are several girls I watch avidly at school, a grade or two above me, whose well-to-do parents take them to the Twin Cities to buy clothes. I notice what they wear and what they eat, what music they listen to, the cars they dream about, and the movie stars they follow. And, like a magpie, I bring these scraps and twigs back to the store. One of these girls will wear a new color or style of belt or a button-plate hat tilted to one side, and that afternoon I'll pore through our vendors' catalogs to find similar designs. I choose mannequins out of a catalog that look like these girls, with pencil-thin eyebrows and rosebud lips and soft, wavy hairstyles, and dress them in the latest styles and colors. I find out the perfumes they favor, like Blue Grass by Elizabeth Arden, and we stock those as well as standard ladies' favorites, such as Joy by Jean Patou and Vol de Nuit by Guerlain. As business grows, we push the shelves closer together, erect special displays at the ends of the aisles, crowd the lotions. When the shop next door, a jeweler's called Riches, goes out of business, I convince Mr. Nielsen to remodel and expand. Inventory will be in the basement instead of in the back, and the store will be organized into departments. We keep prices low, and lower them even more with sales every week and coupons in the paper. We institute a layaway plan so people can buy more expensive items in installments. And we put in a soda fountain as a place people can linger. Before long, the store is thriving. It seems as though we are the only business doing well in this terrible economy.
Did you know your eyes are your best feature?
Tom Price tells me in math class senior year, leaning across my desk to look at them, first one and then the other.
Brown, green, even a little gold in there. I've never seen so many colors in a pair of eyes.
I squirm under his gaze, but when I get home that afternoon, I lean in close to the bathroom mirror and stare at my eyes for a long time. My hair isn't as brassy as it used to be. Over the years, it has turned a deep russet, the color of dead leaves. I've had it cut in the fashionable style, fashionable for our town, at least, right above my shoulders. And when I begin to wear makeup, I have a revelation. I've viewed my life until now as a series of unrelated adaptations, from Irish Neve to American Dorothy to the reincarnated Vivian. Each identity has been projected onto me and fits oddly at first, like a pair of shoes you have to break in before they're comfortable. But with red lipstick, I can fashion a whole new and temporary persona. I can determine my own next incarnation. I attend the homecoming dance with Tom. He shows up at the door with a wrist corsage, a fat white carnation, and two tiny roses. I've sewn my own dress, a pink chiffon version of one Ginger Rogers wore in Swing Time, and Mrs. Nielsen loans me her pearl necklace and matching earrings. Tom is affable and good-natured right up until the moment the whiskey he's tippling from a flask in the pocket of his father's too-big suit coat makes him drunk. Then he gets into a scuffle with another senior on the dance floor and manages to get himself and me ejected from the dance. The next Monday, my 12th grade English teacher, Mrs. Fry, takes me aside after class. "Why are you wasting time with a boy like that?" she scolds. She urges me to apply to colleges out of state. Smith College in Massachusetts, for one, her alma mater. "You'll have a bigger life," she says. "Don't you want that, Vivian?" But though I'm flattered by her interest, I know I'll never go that far. I can't leave the Nielsens, who've come to depend on me for so much. Besides, Tom Price notwithstanding, the life I'm living is big enough for me. As soon as I graduate, I begin to manage the store. I find that I am suited to the task, and that I enjoy it. I'm taking a class in accounting and business administration at St. Olaf College, but my classes meet in the evenings. I hire the workers, 9 in all now, and order much of the merchandise. At night, with Mr. Nielsen, I go over the ledgers. Together, we manage employees' problems, placate customers, massage vendors. I'm constantly angling for the best price, the most attractive bundle of goods, the newest option. Nielsen's is the first place in the county to carry upright electric vacuum cleaners, blenders, freeze-dried coffee. We've never been busier. Girls from my graduating class come into the store brandishing solitaire diamonds like Legion of Honor medals, as if they've accomplished something significant, which I guess they think they have, though all I can see is a future of washing some man's clothes stretching ahead of them. I want nothing to do with marriage. Mrs. Nielsen agrees.
You're young. There'll be time for that, she says.
Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011.
Buying all these fancy vegetables is eating up my whole salary, Dina grumbles. I don't know if we can keep doing this.
Dina's talking about a stir-fry that Molly has thrown together for the three of them after returning from the library in Bar Harbor. Tofu, red and green peppers, black beans, and zucchini. Molly has been cooking quite a bit lately, reasoning that if Dina tries some dishes that don't have animal protein front and center, she'll see how many more options are available. So, in the past week, Molly has made cheese and mushroom quesadillas, vegetarian chili, and eggplant lasagna. Still, Dina complains, it's not filling enough, it's weird. She'd never tried eggplant in her life before Molly roasted one in the oven. And now she complains that it costs too much.
I don't think it's that much more,
Ralph says. Plus the extra cost in general, Dina says under her breath. Let it go, Molly tells herself, but fuck it. Wait a minute. You get paid for having me, right? Dina looks up in surprise, her fork in midair. Ralph raises his eyebrows.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, Dina says.
Doesn't that money cover the cost of having an extra person? Molly asks. More than covers it, right? Honestly, isn't that the reason you take in foster kids at all? Dina stands abruptly. Are you kidding me? She turns to Ralph. Is she really talking to me like this?
Now you two,
Ralph begins with a tremulous smile. It's not us two. Don't you dare group me with her, Dina says.
Well, okay, let's just...
No, Ralph! I've had it! Community service my ass! If you ask me, this girl should be in juvie right now. She's a thief, plain and simple. She steals from the library. Who knows what she steals from us? Or from that old lady. Dina marches over to Molly's bedroom, opens the door, and disappears inside. Hey, Molly says, getting up. A moment later, Dina emerges with a book in her hand. She holds it up like a protest sign. Anne of Green Gables. Where'd you get this? She demands. You can't just... Where'd you get this book? Molly sits back in her chair. Vivian gave it to me. Like hell. Dina flips it open, jabs her finger at the inside cover. Says right here belongs to Dorothy Power. Who's that? Molly turns to Ralph and says slowly, I did not steal that book. Yeah, I'm sure she just borrowed it. Dina points a long pink talon at her. Listen, young lady, we have had nothing but trouble since you came into this house, and I am so over it. I mean it. I am so over it. She stands with her legs apart, breathing shallowly, tossing her blonde, frosted mane like a nervous pony.
Okay, okay, Dina, look.
Ralph has his hands out, patting the air like a conductor.
I think this has gone a little far. Can we just take a deep breath and calm down?
Are you fucking kidding me? Dina practically spits. Ralph looks at Molly, and in his expression she sees something new. He looks weary. He looks over it. I want her out, Dina says.
Dean, out!
Later that evening, Ralph knocks on Molly's bedroom door.
Hey, what are you doing?
He says, looking around. The L.L. Bean duffel bags are splayed wide, and Molly's small collection of books, including Anne of Green Gables, is piled on the floor. Stuffing socks into a plastic Food Mart bag, Molly says, "What does it look like I'm doing?" She's not usually rude to Ralph, but now she figures, who cares? He wasn't exactly watching her back out there.
You can't leave yet. We have to contact social services and all that. It'll be a couple of days, probably.
Molly crams the bag of socks into one end of a duffel, rounding it nicely. Then she starts lining up shoes. The Doc Martens she picked up at a Salvation Army store, black flip-flops, a dog-chewed pair of Birkenstocks that a previous foster mother tossed in the trash and Molly rescued, black Walmart sneakers.
They'll find you someplace better suited, Ralph says.
She looks up at him, brushes the bangs out of her eyes. Oh, yeah? I won't hold my breath.
Come on, Moll. Give me a break.
You give me a break. And don't call me Moll. It's all she can do to restrain herself from flying at his face with her claws out like a feral cat. Fuck him. Fuck him and the bitch she rode in on. She's too old for this. Too old to wait around to be placed with another foster family. Too old to switch schools, move to a new town, submit herself to yet another foster parent's whims. She's so white-hot furious she can barely see. She stokes the fire of her hatred, feeding it tidbits about bigoted idiot Dina and spineless mushmouth Ralph, because she knows that just beyond the rage is a sorrow so enervating it could render her immobile. She needs to keep moving, flickering around the room. She needs to fill her bags and get the hell out of here. Ralph hovers, uncertain, as always. She knows he's caught between her and Dina, and utterly unequipped to handle either of them. She almost feels sorry for him, the pusillanimous wretch.
I have somewhere to go, so don't worry about it, she says.
To Jack's, you mean?
Maybe. Actually, no. She could no more go to Jack's than she could get a room at the Bar Harbor Inn. Yes, I'd prefer a water view and send up a mango smoothie, thanks. Things between them are still strained, but even if things were fine, Terry would never allow her to stay overnight. Ralph sighs.
Well, I get why you don't want to stay here.
She gives him a look. No shit, Sherlock.
Let me know if I can drive you any place.
I'll be fine, she says, dropping a pile of black t-shirts in the bag and standing there with folded arms until he slinks out. So where the hell can she go? There's $213 left in Molly's savings account from the minimum wage job she had last summer scooping ice cream in Bar Harbor. She could take a bus to Bangor, or Portland, or maybe even Boston. But what then? She wonders, not for the first time, about her mother. Maybe she's better. Maybe she's clean and sober now, with some kind of steady job. Molly's always resisted the urge to look for her, dreading what she might find. But desperate times, and who knows? The state loves it when biological parents get their shit together. This could be an opportunity for both of them. Before she can change her mind, she crawls over to her sleeping laptop, propped open on her bed, and taps the keyboard to nudge it awake. She Googles Donna Ayer, Maine. The first listing is an invitation to view Donna Ayer's professional profile on LinkedIn. Unlikely. Next is a PDF of Yarmouth City Council members that includes a Donna Ayer. Even more unlikely. Third down is a wedding announcement. A Donna Halsey married Rob Ayer, an Air Force pilot, in Mattawamkeag in March. No. And finally, yep, here she is. Molly's mother, in a small item in the Bangor Daily News. Clicking through to the article, Molly finds herself staring at her mother's mugshot. There's no question it's her, though she's wan, squinty, and decidedly worse for wear. Arrested 3 months ago for stealing OxyContin from a pharmacy in Old Town with a guy named Dwayne Bordick, 23, Ayer is being held in lieu of bond, the article says, at the Penobscot County Jail in Bangor. Well, that was easy enough. Can't go there. What now? Looking up homeless shelters online, Molly finds one in Ellsworth, but it says that patrons have to be 18 or older, unless with a parent.
The Seacoast Mission in Bar Harbor has a food pantry, though no overnight accommodations.
So what about Vivian?
That house has 14 rooms. Vivian lives in about 3 of them. She's almost certainly home. After all, she never goes anywhere. Molly glances at the time on her phone. 6:45 p.m. That's not too late to call her, is it? But now that she thinks about it, she's never actually seen Vivian talking on the phone. Maybe it would be better to take the Island Explorer over there to talk with her in person. And if she says no, well, maybe Molly could just sleep in her garage tonight. Tomorrow, with a clear head, she'll figure out what to do. Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011.